Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, coming to you from attackthesystem.com. In this particular broadcast, I want to talk about a controversy that has been associated with attackthesystem.com for quite some time, and it really involves an issue that is very taboo in many ways. And that's this question of white nationalism. White nationalism as a philosophy, as an ideology, as a political movement. For quite some time, Attack the System has been criticized and attacked by various detractors for allegedly being a white nationalist movement or organization, or for having been associated with so-called white nationalists. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of these kinds of issues in this particular program and really explore this controversy on a number of different levels. First of all, I want to give a little bit of background as to how this got to be such a controversial issue with AttackTheSystem.com. And I also want to reflect a little bit on the issue of white nationalism itself, or the ideology of white nationalism. As for the backstory, the first thing that I should probably say as a disclaimer is that I am not a white nationalist. I have never been a white nationalist, and I've never been a nationalist of any kind. I am and always have been an anarchist. I've been an anarchist for as long as I have been politically conscious, and we're talking about 25 to 30 years now. I'm one of those rare individuals who never was anything other than an anarchist. As far as my own upbringing and background, I grew up in the South in the 1970s and early 80s, and I certainly grew up in a very conservative environment by conventional standards. I grew up in the evangelical and fundamentalist Christian communities, and in those communities, certainly social and cultural conservatism is the norm, and also in the environment that I grew up in, there were certainly a lot of very conservative attitudes about issues like race as well. But as a young person, as a kid, I never really absorbed much of that. For example, there's no one today that would mistake me for being any kind of Christian fundamentalist, and I find it odd that I'm often labeled a white nationalist by my critics or enemies, because that's very far removed from what my actual views are as well. So I want to talk a little bit about how some of these controversies developed, and I want to talk a little bit about what my actual views are, and I want to talk a little bit about this question of white nationalism and try to pursue the question from an objective, somewhat scholarly perspective if we can. One thing that's interesting is that in examining the phenomena of white nationalism, it's very, very rare that you are able to find any kind of objective research or objective scholarship on the question of white nationalism. In fact, the only work of substance, of quality, that I have ever been able to find is a book that was published back in the early 2000s. The author is Carol Swain, and the book is called The New White Nationalism in America. Carol Swain is an interesting person. She's actually an African-American woman, a law professor at Vanderbilt, or she was. I'm not sure where she is now. And she also grew up in the same area that I grew up in. I grew up in a place called Lynchburg, Virginia, and she originates from Roanoke, Virginia, which is about an hour away. She certainly, comes from a similar geographical region, and she's a little bit older than I am. But we both come from the same area and, roughly the same time period. And obviously from a different perspective in terms of ethnic experience and so forth. But Carol Swain's book, The New White Nationalism in America, that was published back in, I believe, 2002, is widely available. You can order it online. You can get it from Amazon. You can find several intelligent reviews of it online as well. But it's a book that's well worth reading, and it's a book that probably has influenced my own thinking on white nationalism as much as any other. And it's the only work I know of that deals with the question of white nationalism in a serious, objective, scholarly manner. Virtually all other works on white nationalism are either written by white nationalists themselves for the purpose of promoting their own point of view, or else they're written from these by these so-called watchdog groups or by individuals associated with watchdog groups. Groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and so forth, which is probably the most famous and influential one, but there are a number of others as well. And there's a virtual cottage industry out there of so-called watchdog groups that are out there trying to expose all the evil neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klanners and racists and white nationalists or whatever that are supposedly hiding behind every rock. So it's very difficult to find literature that deals with this issue of white nationalism in any kind of serious, honest, intelligent manner. And in fact, I found that in personal experience and in conversations with people, that many people, including people who are otherwise intelligent, otherwise reasonable, otherwise insightful people, when you start bringing up this question of white nationalism, they just seem to lose their minds in some ways. They just seem to have some kind of mental block that keeps them from considering these questions in a way that is objective and more academic and more scholarly. I think there are certain reasons for that. I'll get into that in a little bit. But when I have this discussion with people, I'm always reminded of something that William F. Buckley wrote about the war on drugs way back in the early 90s. The late William F. Buckley, one of the founders of the post-war conservative movement, and certainly a man that I have plenty of disagreements with, or had plenty of disagreements with. But Bill Buckley was an interesting character in that he was both a staunch conservative and a harsh critic of the war on drugs. And he observed at one point that he had found that when it came to the question of drug policy, that rational thinking had just completely disappeared from society. And of course, now he was writing back in the late 80s, early 90s, when drug war rhetoric was at its peak and so forth. I mean, while the drug war continues, the rhetoric that you see coming from the government and the media and so forth has subsided somewhat. But I found that to be the case with white nationalism as well, that there are many people who are otherwise intelligent and reasonable and sensible people who just can't discuss the question in a way that is mature and adult-like and serious. So I want to try to do that a little bit this evening. But as first, in terms of my own personal background and my own views on some of these kinds of issues, and as far as the positions of Attack the System and American Revolutionary Vanguard, when I was growing up, I was probably the most liberal person in the environment that I was in. I grew up in the South in the 70s in the rural small town areas of Virginia. And virtually all white people in that kind of environment would certainly be considered racist by contemporary standards, and even by the standards of the time, probably would have been considered racist. And I was always one of those people that never really bought into that. I never really bought into a lot of stuff that I grew up with. When I was growing up, I mentioned I was a Christian fundamentalist, but I left that and put all that behind me when I was in my early teens. And some of the more conservative attitudes about issues like race was something I never really bought into, or certainly grew out of by the time I was old enough to have any ideas of my own. But what was interesting to me, though, as a young man when I was in my 20s, is when I started becoming involved with the radical left subculture and started observing some of these things that are now called political correctness. It wasn't really called that back then. But what was interesting about that is that when I first started coming across some of those kinds of ideas, it was completely foreign to anything I had ever known from my own upbringing. In some ways, it was almost like going to another planet, but certainly like going to a foreign country with a totally different language and totally different customs and stuff like that. It was somewhat similar to that, I suppose. At least people who have had that experience have their experiences sound a lot like mine. And perhaps it's for that reason that I never really imbibed the whole PC mentality either, because I didn't grow up with it. I lived in a time before it really came to dominate the media the way that it does now. And I wasn't educated in the public school system when I was growing up, except for the tail end of my high school career and all that. So when I first started encountering some of this stuff, political correctness, I was always amazed by how similar it was to some of the stuff that I had grown up with. In fact, it always seemed to be a mirror opposite in terms of rhetoric, but it, sharp parallels in terms of the psychology and in terms of the worldview that was being espoused. So I'll get into that in a little bit as well. But when I first became interested in anarchism, which was a quarter of a century, almost 30 years ago now, quite some time ago. But I got into anarchism not through associating with the punk rock subculture, which I was never really a part of. In fact, it really wasn't much of a subculture back in those days. It only existed in the larger cities and so forth, where I didn't come from that kind of background geographically. I didn't get into it by associating with student radicals, at least not initially. All of the different stories that people will tell you about how they became interested in anarchism, none of that really applied to me. I became interested in it largely just by reading about it in very generic sources like the books you find in the library or the encyclopedia and things like that. And I won't go into the background of all that, but I was an anarchist before I really even knew any other anarchists. And when I first started becoming involved in the organized anarchist movement, which some people, I guess, would say is a contradiction in terms, when I first became involved with all that, right from the start, I started to notice some serious issues in that it seemed to me that many people in the anarchist milieu, as it was, and we're talking about the late 1980s now, mid to late 1980s, really had everything except promoting anarchist revolution on their minds. And I used to go to gatherings of these people in these groups and joined a lot of their organizations and read all their publications. And one thing I used to wonder about was, when are we going to get down to this business of actually overthrowing the government and overthrowing the ruling class and fighting the imperialists and things that anarchism is supposed to be about? And instead, I noticed that a lot of anarchists were into some fairly outlandish, marginal lifestyles, and with that, I won't go into the details of all of that. It's still out there. I mean, those of you who have any familiarity with the anarchist milieu know what I'm talking about. And it also seemed that there were a lot of people who were more about promoting demographic conflict than in attacking the state or attacking the ruling class or any of that per se. For instance, some of you know that I was very briefly associated with a group called Love and Rage. There was a leftist anarchist group called the Love and Rage Revolutionary Anarchist Federation. It was around back in the late 80s and early 90s, and I was actually at the founding conference of that and quickly broke with that project. And probably the way I first started to become known in the anarchist milieu was as an outspoken public critic of the Love and Rage group. And the reason that I was so outspoken in my criticisms of them was because this group seemed to me to be about everything but promoting the anarchist struggle against the state. Rather, they were just a very generic far leftist group, they were more interested in promoting demographic conflict in terms of, you know, blacks against whites and men against women and gays against straights and natives against immigrants and that kind of thing. All of the kind of stuff that, you know, we're familiar with today, as and called political correctness. And it seemed to me that many of their views were, in fact, the mirror image of the people they claim to be opposing. You know, it's all about the race war, the class war, the gender war, and so forth. And I always thought, well, that's interesting, but again, that has nothing to do with anarchism. Anarchism is about abolishing the state, and it's about attacking institutions of exploitation that are aligned with the state. It's not about attacking races and genders and religions and cultures and things like that. So I became very critical of that project, and I realized over time that the anarchist movement in North America, at least, was seriously lacking and had no revolutionary potential. And so I decided along the way that there needed to be a different kind of anarchist movement. And that was really the beginnings of Attack the System, although Attack the System didn't really go online until 2001, about 12 years ago, 13 years ago. It took a while for me to really develop some of these ideas. But the conclusion that I came to from my early experiences in the anarchist movement is that we can't have a politically successful anarchist movement that's simply about either promoting demographic conflict, like the Love and Rage group, or is simply about promoting the most fringe types of lifestyles, like some of the other anarchists were interested in. And it couldn't be about old-fashioned pre-World War II models of class struggle either. And I used to belong to a number of groups like that. And there are groups like that that are still around. The libcom.org website is probably the most prominent point of view, prominent group representing that point of view. You know, classical proletarianism. You know, I knew from my efforts at doing strike support work and actually working with labor unions in the 80s, and I did strike support work for some fairly big strikes. The Pittston coal miners in Southwest Virginia when they went on strike, the Eastern Airlines workers, the Hormel meat packers, the Greyhound bus drivers. I worked on a lot of those strikes in the 80s, and what I generally found is that workers really had no so-called class consciousness whatsoever. Most of those guys, you couldn't even get them to show up to do picket line duty, much less carry out any kind of revolution like these warmed over old leftists tended to dream about. So I realized that wasn't really a workable perspective either. So over time, I started to develop an alternative point of view that was rooted in the idea that in the 21st century, anarchism has to be more than what it was in the 19th. Oh, I won't say more. It has to be different than what it was in the 19th and 20th centuries, and that it's the, you know, the historical classical labor movement, at least in the Western industrialized world, is now a thing of the past. It's something that's become normal, status quo, and incorporated into the system. And likewise, all of the kinds of social radicalism that came out of the 1960s and 70s, all of that is mainstream now. It's the status quo. It's middle of the road. And I realized that, you know, as far back as 20 years ago. So I started working on developing a new form of anarchism, and that would be more about creating a strategic alliance of enemies of the state from all across the spectrum. You know, that is practicing what used to be called anarchism without adjectives. That is, we recognize the legitimacy of all the different anarchist factions. And then we go out and try and recruit and organize from all sorts of other movements and ideological factions and demographic groups and political issues and so forth towards this common purpose of attacking the state, of attacking the state's acts of war and imperialist aggression, of attacking the state-allied institutions like the institutions of state capitalism, and doing so from a point of view that emphasizes both libertarianism, and that is individual freedom against the state and against institutional authority, and populism, the idea of promoting the struggle of the people, you know, ordinary folks, against the elite, whose boot they are under. So that was the approach to anarchism that I developed, and I began to express that point of view and agitate for it, and I started the attackthesystem.com website to promote this point of view. And if you go to our website, attackthesystem.com, you look at our statement of purpose. You can go to the homepage and just click on the link that says statement of purpose. You know, in the very introductory part of it, you get a very basic idea of what we're all about. You know, we advocate a very far-reaching anarchism without adjectives. We recognize all the different brands of anarchism and libertarianism and anti-state radicalism, and as well as ideological movements that are basically our cousins or brothers in some particular way, who certainly overlap with much of what we do. And then we also seek to connect with people from other philosophical systems and ideological systems that with whom we might have something in common, and try to build a movement, an actual movement of enemies of the state and enemies of the system. And one thing that I found interesting when I first formed AttackTheSystem.com and started to advocate for this point of view is that initially I thought that most of the criticism that I would receive would come from the right. You know, I started Attack the System in 2001, which was the year that George W. Bush took office. In fact, I think it was the same month. And, of course, that was the year that the September 11th issue happened, and all the backlash and fallout from that. So initially, I thought that most of the criticism that we would receive at Attack the System would be from the far right. That is, I won't say the far right. I'll say the center right. Maybe just standard conservative Republican types, your standard patriotic, you know, God bless America, you know, vote Republican type, you know, those kinds of people. The kinds of folks that in the back during the Richard Nixon era used to have the slogan love it or leave it, or you know, the gung-ho Reaganites from the 80s. I initially thought most of our criticism would come from that camp because clearly, just about everything that I've ever written in terms of political philosophy or ideology or issues, and most of everything that's ever been posted on AttackTheSystem.com over the years has a very strong anti-American flavor to it, in the sense that the jingoist, neocon-oriented, Republican Party-oriented, Fox News-oriented, right-wing talk radio-oriented people define as anti-Americanism. We certainly are enemies of the American empire, without a doubt. We're enemies of the American empire every bit as much as the Islamic fundamentalists are, every bit as much as the populist movements in Latin America are, every bit as much as the guerrilla movements in Asia are. We are certainly a very anti-U.S. imperialist movement. And we're certainly enemies of the American state. I mentioned in a recent podcast that, you know, my problem with President Obama is not that I'm a Republican, or not that I don't like Obamacare or anything like that. My problem with it, with President Obama, is I just don't recognize the state that he represents, and it wouldn't matter to me who the U.S. president was, whether John McCain or Mitt Romney had been the victor in some of the last couple of elections, or I'd feel the same way. And I felt the same way when George W. Bush was president, when Bill Clinton was president, and going on back. So certainly by the standards of the conventional right wing, the right wing talk radio, Fox News, Republican Party types, we are very anti-American, and certainly someone like Sean Hannity would consider us to be very anti-American. So initially, I thought most of our criticism would come from that camp, from these hardcore, you know, pro-American, flag-waving, jingoist types. But that interestingly did not turn out to be the case. Most of our criticism, well, I mean, we've certainly gotten criticism from some of those camps, but most of the criticism that AttackTheSystem.com and American Revolutionary Vanguard has received, and most of the criticism that I've received personally have come from the left, have come from the left who have sought to label us as fascist and racist and neo-Nazi and all kinds of things, which is very interesting because that's really the polar opposite of what we are. Those particular ideologies are polar opposite of what we are. So it is interesting that there are some people who try to put that label on us. In looking at, you know, I've had people ask me about that. I've had people ask me, say, why is it that they say that about Attack the System? Why do some people say that Attack the System, American Revolutionary Vanguard, is a neo-fascist movement? Or why do they say that you, Keith Preston, are a fascist? And so I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think there's a lot of reasons why the left puts that label on us. And one reason has to do with my own views on political strategy. I think if I had to narrow it down to one thing above all else, it would be that. And that is that my view when it comes to strategy and the point of view that I've advocated for years is that in the process of building a united revolutionary front against the state, which is, as anarchists, is what we should be aiming towards, it's necessary, it's appropriate and necessary to include within our revolutionary front people who have cultural values and personal values from all over the spectrum of opinion. For example, it's quite likely that in a mass movement to oppose the state and imperialism and state-allied institutions, we would have people with all different types of religious beliefs. There would certainly be atheists. There would probably be some, you know, evangelical Christians and some more liberal Christians and some Catholics and other types of Christians and Muslims and people who believe in astrology and people who are into the occult and the New Age spiritualities and Hindus and all sorts of other points of view. Likewise, it's probable that there would be all sorts of beliefs about sexual mores and so forth, you know, people who believe in abstinence and chastity and things like that as an ideal, people who take a very libertine approach to sexuality. There might be people who are vegetarians who, for ethical or philosophical or political or health reasons or whatever, don't believe in eating animals for food. There would certainly be other people who don't agree with that. You know, there would be people who abstain from drugs and alcohol, people who don't, people who smoke, people who don't. There would be people from all kinds of ethnic communities all across the spectrum of ethnic backgrounds. And you'd also have people with all different sorts of opinions about controversial public issues like abortion and capital punishment and same-sex marriage and race relations and gender roles and religious beliefs and so many other things. That's just what you would find in the kind of anti-state mass movement that we at Attack the System aim to build, not only in North America, but in other parts of the world as well, because that's just how politics is done. And it's not just a matter of being against the state. We could say the same thing about any other kind of movement. For instance, the pro-life movement is comprised of all sorts of people with all sorts of beliefs. You have Catholics, you have evangelical Christian fundamentalists, you have people with secular religious beliefs who happen to oppose abortion. You know, you have men and women, you have all, you know, you have Democrats and Republicans, you have people of all races. The same is true of the movement, the pro-gun rights, pro-Second Amendment movement. You have people from a lot of different kinds of beliefs and backgrounds in that. If you go to an anti-war rally, you find the same thing. And that would certainly be true of an anti-state movement. In an anti-state movement, you would have all kinds of people who view themselves as under attack by the state for all kinds of reasons and have all sorts of beliefs about all different things that are controversial in nature. And that's just how it is. That's just how politics works. And you can find that in the mainstream political parties. You can, in the Republicans, you've got everything from the more radical members of the religious right all the way over to the log cabin Republicans and GOP proud, which are gay rights Republicans. And you certainly have Republicans that are at least that are somewhat racist in their opinions, at least on a residual level or perhaps closeted level. And then you also have African-American Republicans, and you have moderate Republicans and liberal Republicans and conservative Republicans. And the same is true, of course, on the Democratic Party side. The Democratic Party probably has a lot more diversity within it than the Republican Party does. You know, there are conservative Democrats, and then there are Democrats who are almost in the neo-Marxist or neo-communist camp. And that's how an anti-state movement would be. An anti-state movement would include all different kinds of people and with different beliefs and different values. And that includes people who have conservative views about all sorts of things. And I think that's really the main reason why the left attacks us, because they just can't stand the idea that within our own camps we may have people that aren't necessarily enamored of, say, same-sex marriage, or who might have a negative view of abortion, or might have some sort of traditional religious belief or practice, or, you know, might not have the most liberal attitudes about race in many instances, and many other things, you know, who may be for capital punishment or may be critical of immigration. And, you know, my view is that the anti-state movement should be for all anti-statists. It shouldn't matter what else you believe or what else that you, or how you live your private life and things like that. You know, just like, you know, if you have a movement for conservatives who want to say, let's say you have an organization whose purpose is to reduce taxes and control government spending, like mainstream fiscal conservatives want to do, right? Well, something like that normally would be open to, you know, people who are otherwise liberal on many other issues, who are conservative on many other issues, who are moderate on many other issues. And that's really how Attack the System is. We're a movement to oppose the state. We're a movement to oppose the American empire. We're a movement to oppose the police state, to oppose the state capitalist ruling class. And to do that, to build a movement of that type, it's necessary to include people with all kinds of beliefs and values and backgrounds, and to go out and try to connect with people with all sorts of different kinds of beliefs and different reasons for opposing the state and take a look at some of their issues and see what commonalities there are. Now, another thing that seems to really stick in the craw of our critics on the left is our recognition of a tendency called the National Anarchist. The National Anarchists, I first discovered them probably about 12, 13 years ago, about the time that I was really putting AttackTheSystem.com together. And, you know, I consider national anarchism to be a legitimate branch of anarchism. I know most of the leading national anarchists personally, and I know a whole lot of other national anarchists who aren't perhaps well known. And from everything I can tell, based on years of experience and association with them, the majority of national anarchists certainly seem to be sincere in their anti-state radicalism, just like the majority of anarcho-capitalists seem to be sincere, and probably the majority of left anarchists in their own way are somewhat sincere, and the majority of classical syndicalist model anarchists are sincere. And, of course, the controversy is the fact that some people associated with national anarchism either were at one point associated with white nationalism or may carry some residual influences of that type with them. But I fail to see really how that's an issue any more than, say, the fact that you, within the ranks of the left anarchist, you have former Marxists, former communists, who may bring residual influences of that, and within the anarcho-capitalist movement, you have residual capitalists, or whatever you'd call them, residual conservatives, or residual Tories, or whatever. But for some reason, the national anarchist really seemed to set some people off, and it seems to be because of the peripheral overlap of national anarchism with white nationalism. Another thing that seems to be the source of the fascist and neo-Nazi label that gets put on us is the fact that in the early days of Attack the System, I tended to take a very hardline anti-Zionist stance, and I still am a very hardline anti-Zionist, not so much in the sense that I want Israel to disappear as a national entity or anything like that. I'm for self-determination for all people, and that includes Jewish people as well as other people. I am critical of Israel's aggression towards some of its neighbors and its subjugation of the Palestinian people. I'm certainly very sympathetic to the circumstances that the Palestinian people are in. But as an advocate of self-determination for all people, I don't really see that Israel itself, the existence of it, is a problem. But I am very critical and have been for quite some time of the influence of organized Zionism on American foreign policy, because I don't see that as being a positive thing at all. And in the early years of Attack the System, I tended to focus on that a lot more. And the reason why was because it was the era of the neocons' wars. This is when the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and all of that were beginning. And it was clear to me that some Zionist interests had a major hand in that. Certainly, they weren't the only guilty party, but they were one of the major guilty parties. Ironically, my actual criticism of the relationship between American imperialism and Zionism isn't really rooted in some of the traditional anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish conspiracy theories. If you take a look at some of those ideas and listen to some of the rhetoric of some of those people, you get the idea that if they find a pothole in the road, well, it's because these pesky Jews are out there ripping up the pavement just to make life difficult for Aryan motorists or whatever, and that's not really my perspective at all. My perspective on the question of Zionism is actually more in line with someone like James Patras. James Patras is a writer from the left. He's a Marxist. He's a very outspoken champion of some of the radical populist movements in Latin America. Very strong critic of American imperialism, somewhat Marxist in his orientation, but he published a book some years ago called The Power of Israel Over the United States, and that really goes into a lot of detail or outlining the kind of influence that the pro-Israel lobby and pro-Israel forces in the United States have over American foreign policy. Of course, there's also the work by Mears Hymer and Walt that came out some years ago, really about the same time as the Petras book, that also discusses the role of the Israel lobby in the formulation of American foreign policy. And those two works really are more in line with my own thinking than some of the other stuff that's normally associated with anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and the like. But because I did take this hardline anti-Zionist position in the early years of Attack the System, that enhanced the, for better or worse, enhanced the neo-Nazi reputation of Attack the System. And there are some other issues as well, but it seems to me that primarily it was these things that I mentioned earlier. My recognition of the necessity of including people from all across the cultural spectrum, not just cultural leftists, in the anti-state movement, my recognition of the national anarchist as a legitimate branch of anarchism, my criticisms of Zionism. Also, one thing that was interesting is that the more I started to advocate for pan-secessionism as a strategic paradigm for 21st century anarchism, I also noticed that my audience among the far right tended to increase, and that was true as well from my anti-Zionist position. I know when I became a public, outspoken critic of Zionism, I used to get banned letters from neo-Nazis and that sort of thing all the time. As I started advocating secession, I started getting fan letters and fan mail and building a fairly large audience among the far right in the United States, because that's a political, cultural undercurrent where secessionism has a large amount of sympathy. And I also think that one thing that tended to grow my audience on the far right was my actual theory of totalitarian humanism. And the way I developed that was rather interesting in the sense that I never really paid much attention to political correctness prior to, I'd say, maybe the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, I certainly knew what it was. I really never had much use for it. But I thought a lot of the criticisms of it were overblown. And what motivated me to really take a harder look at it was some of the criticism that I would get from the left over some of the things that I just mentioned. And I started looking a little bit deeper into the political correctness and its origins and its ideological foundations and its historical background and so forth, and started becoming a lot more critical of it. And totalitarian humanism was the label that I gave to it. I think other labels like cultural Marxism and so forth aren't really as explanatory. And so as I started to criticize this phenomena of what I call totalitarian humanism, I started getting an even larger audience among the far right, and more and more I was being invited to write for their publications and so forth, and I was being interviewed on their radio programs. And of course, through that association, because I had such a large audience there, a lot of the left tended to turn up their own rhetoric against me about how I'm a neo-Nazi and a fascist and a racist and all that kind of stuff. And again, you know, the work that I've done in the past with the so-called far right is really no different than the work I've done from the far left. In the late 1980s, I used to do a lot of work with the far left. I used to collaborate with communists and liberation theology Christians and a lot of other people to organize opposition to American foreign policy. And many years later, I would collaborate with people on the far right to organize opposition to American foreign policy and also to political correctness and things like that. And that's how I do things. Politics is about getting results. It's about finding people who you might share a common interest with on certain things, maybe not everything, but on certain things, and taking it from there, rather than about imposing ideological litmus tests and standards of ideological purity and things like that. So that's a little bit of the background about how Attack the System, which is a revolutionary anarchist group, somehow started getting the fascist, racist, white nationalist, neo-Nazi, yada, yada, yada label put on it over the years. We are anarchists. Everybody that is part of our circle is an anarchist of some type, or at least a radical decentralist of some type. We have people in our circle who come from all over the cultural spectrum in terms of some on the cultural right, some on the cultural left. I personally am probably more of a cultural centrist. But the common aim that we have is the struggle against the state and the wider struggle against imperialism and the U.S. empire and related institutions. But at this point, some of the listeners are probably thinking, okay, well, that's great, but what does that have to do with actually critiquing white nationalism or discussing white nationalism? So far, I've just been discussing the history of the relationship between Attack the System and white nationalism and why many leftists continue to label us a white nationalist movement and so forth, when that clearly is not the case at all. We are an anarchist movement that includes within it people from many different kinds of beliefs and cultural backgrounds about all sorts of things. But reflecting a bit on this question of white nationalism and what it is and trying to assess it in some sort of objective and scholarly way, I think white nationalism has to be understood in the same way that any other philosophical system is understood. For instance, take Marxism. There are many things about Marxism where I think the Marxists have a valid point. For instance, I think Marxists tend to be fairly good economic historians. Marxists tend to be pretty good at in the field of political economy. They tend to be very good class theorists. Where I think they fall short is in some other areas. I don't think they're very good psychologists. I don't think they have a very good understanding of human nature. I don't think they're very good philosophers generally. I don't think they're very good at microeconomics. But you know, when you read the works of Marxist economists and writers and historians, you have to take the good with the bad. And the same thing is true with any other philosophy, whether it's conservatism or liberalism or all the different schools of anarchism, and the same is true with white nationalism. When the thing to do when you encounter a philosophical system like white nationalism or a movement like white nationalism is to actually listen to what the people involved are saying and try to figure out where they're coming from and try to figure out what valid issues they may raise and try to differentiate that from things that might be a little bit more dubious in nature and try to be objective and open-minded and understand other people's points of view. And that's what I started to doing over time. Now, over time, as I started on one hand having a much larger audience of white nationalists from my own work on one hand, as well as other people from the so-called far right, and at the same time getting this white nationalist, et cetera, label put on me by critics from the left, and falsely so, you know, the more I started to take a look at the philosophy and movement of white nationalism and try to understand it a little bit better and try to come up with some sort of objective assessment of it and some sort of balanced opinion on it. Now, as to what I personally think about white nationalism, you know, as an anarchist, I'm an enemy of the state. And that's any kind of statism. I'm against liberal statism. I'm against conservative statism. I'm against fascist statism. I'm against theocratic statism. And I would be against white nationalist statism as well, just like I'd be against black nationalist statism. So, and there are people within the white nationalist milieu who have a very state-centric philosophy. And ideologies, of course, that are totalitarian in nature and deify the state, like fascism, classical fascism, or like, say, National Socialism, that's, of course, the polar opposite of anarchism. It doesn't get any more far removed than that. So that would be my first point of departure with white nationalism, at least the brands of white nationalism that have a very state-centric outlook. But beyond that, though, I do first and foremost, as an anarchist, advocate freedom of speech and freedom of opinion for everyone. Now, before we can even really get to anything else, if we anarchists take our anarchism seriously at all, then one of our core building blocks of our whole philosophy has to be that we respect the right of other people to hold their opinion, to express their opinion, and to give a fair hearing to all opinions. I think that's a very important value, and that's something that most political ideologues, and it's not just anarchists, and it's not just white nationalists, and it's not just leftists. I've noticed that most political ideologues of any stripe seem to have a serious problem with this idea that the basis of any kind of functional political order has to be one where people are entitled to their opinion, they're entitled to express their opinion, they're entitled to a fair hearing for their opinion. And I would apply that standard to white nationalists as much as anyone else. White nationalists have as much right to their opinion, to express their opinion, to a fair hearing for their opinion as any other point of view, liberals, conservatives, anarchists, Marxists, or whatever. Now, I'm also a strong advocate as an anarchist of freedom of association. And you know, one thing that's happened in our own societies, you know, in Western industrialized societies in recent decades, is that freedom of association has been curbed to an ever greater degree for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons is to ostensibly create rights for people that are traditionally excluded or disadvantaged from mainstream society. And of course, in our own society in the United States, we have a wide array of anti-discrimination laws that essentially eradicate freedom of association in a lot of different areas, you know, race, religion, gender, nationality, and many other things. And there are movements out there to increasingly expand the whole umbrella of anti-discrimination laws to ever more groups and ever more things. I've come across proposed legislation to prevent discrimination against alcoholics and drug addicts or criminals, or and I think nowadays more and more American states and localities are including transsexuals and people like that under the anti-discrimination umbrella. And I actually have mixed feelings about that. As an anarchist, as a libertarian, I am very big on the right of freedom of association, just like I'm very big on the right of freedom of speech and the right of freedom of religion. You know, I think when it comes to free speech, you should be able to express any kind of opinion you want about anything. It doesn't matter what other people think of it. You can, even if 99.99% of all people everywhere think it's a ridiculous or terrible opinion, you still have the right to that opinion. And I would say the same thing about freedom of religion. In my view, you have the right to practice whatever kind of religion you want. If you want to worship a rock, you want to worship your car, and there are some pretty crazy religions out there, but, you have the right to that belief system. And I'd say the same about freedom of association. If you want to form a community, an organization, a club, a business, or whatever else that excludes whomever you want for whatever reason you want, you generally should be able to do that. If you want to say, we don't want to have any redheads in our club, or we don't want to have any people who wear brown pants in our club or whatever, then you should be able to do that. And I would defend the right to exclude or discriminate along those lines, along all of the traditional taboo lines: race, gender, sexual orientation, nationality, disability, religion, et cetera, and so forth. Now, the other side of that, though, is that we do live in a very state-saturated society, where the state is involved in virtually every aspect of life for a lot of reasons. And we also have an economic system where corporate entities and other institutions that are aligned with the state tend to dominate the economy, the banking establishment and so forth. So in that context, I generally lean towards the idea that, in fact, I'm certain that I lean towards the idea that that government should not be able to discriminate, or that corporate entities should not be able to discriminate. I don't have a problem, for example, with a rule that says General Motors cannot refuse to hire black employees just because they're black, or Mormon employees just because they're Mormon, or gay employees just because they're gay. I don't consider General Motors' rights to be infringed on in that sense, because they are an institution that is, propped up and aligned with the state. They're essentially part of the economic branches of the state. And of course, certainly government should not be able to discriminate in terms of providing services. I mean, they can't say, well, we're going to have a trash collection service only for German and Irish Americans, but not for Swedish and Norwegian Americans, or something like that. So anti-discrimination rules within the context of the state-dominated, corporate-dominated society that we have do have their place. But when it comes to purely voluntary entities, I would defend the right to discriminate all you want. And of course, that's something of an anathema to many people on the left, including many so-called libertarians and anarchists. And discussing that question with many of them, they just can't seem to bear the idea that somebody somewhere might discriminate against somebody along these kinds of taboo lines. But I think if we are consistent in our anarchism, then we have to recognize their right to do that. I mean, we can individually think whatever we want about it, but it's something that we have to respect on a political level. Now, I've been asked before about some of my associations with white nationalists by people from the left and elsewhere, and one of the things they'll ask me is, do you think, Keith, that there is anything good about these people, or do you think that any of their ideas are valid at all? And I want to try to answer that question a bit in terms of the issues that white nationalists raise that I think are serious and legitimate issues in many instances, and distinguish that from other ideas that you find in some of those camps that are more dubious in nature. One issue that is a major issue for many white nationalists is affirmative action. And affirmative action, I think, is something that people with reasonable ideas and good intentions can disagree on. There's something to be said for the point of view that people who have traditionally been excluded or people who are disadvantaged in some particular way should be given a helping hand or some sort of consideration to make up for that. Affirmative action doesn't necessarily have to be race oriented either. It could be class oriented. And you know, as an anarchist, as a libertarian, I advocate ultimately the creation of societies and whole civilizations that are absent of the influence of states and corporations and the kinds of institutions we're familiar with today. And it's certainly true that the kinds of communities you would find in an anarchist society could, if they wanted to, have some kind of affirmative action. It's certainly true, an anarcho-syndicalist labor federation could have some kind of affirmative action or not. There's any kind of options are available on an institutional level when we're talking about the wider anarchist philosophy and paradigm. On the other hand, though, it's certainly valid to criticize affirmative action as potentially discriminating against other people. You know, I know from my own experience in the public sector and in the academic world, I'm always amazed at how many different kinds of special programs there are to help people that are ostensibly disadvantaged or have suffered previous exclusion and so forth. And there's certainly the question arises, well, when does that become discriminatory from the other end? There's also the question of meritocracy. Is it ever appropriate to give someone admission to college or a job or anything like that solely on the basis of what they are as opposed to what they have done? And, there have been some research done showing how often or at least sometimes people who were flagrantly incompetent have been given positions solely because they were filling quotas related to some sort of policy of that type. So that's another side of the issue. Another issue that white nationalists tend to raise is mass immigration. And again, immigration policy and immigration itself is something that anarchists and libertarians can and do disagree on. There is a variety of opinions on that within the wider libertarian camp. You have some anarchists, usually from the left and left libertarians, who are zealous proponents of immigration. There can't be enough of it in their view. You have other more right-wing libertarians and some anarcho-capitalists, like, say, Hans Hermann Hoppe, who are very critical of mass immigration. I gave a lecture to the National Policy Institute, which is a white nationalist organization. I was invited by them to give a talk on mass immigration a couple of years ago and how that relates to my theory of totalitarian humanism. And the basis of the talk that I gave is I was trying to explain why elite opinion across the spectrum of mainstream institutions tends to generally have a favorable view of mass immigration and what the ideological underpinnings behind that are, as well as the various political interests and so forth. Immigration is something that reasonable and honest people can disagree on. On one hand, it's true that there's always going to be migration of peoples. I mean, people are always going to be moving about and meeting other people and intermixing with other people. There's no way to control that, or I don't know that it needs to be controlled. On the other hand, it's also true that much of the mass immigration that we're experiencing certainly in the Western societies today and other places as well, is driven by the institutional apparatuses that dominate those societies, like state capitalism, like governments, and so forth. And on those grounds, I think that mass immigration deserves much criticism, or certainly I would say that people who criticize mass immigration should certainly be given a fair hearing and be given their seat at the table. It's no need to make threats of violence and things like that against people who simply criticize mass immigration, which is what leftists will sometimes do. There's also the question of multiculturalism. This is something that white nationalists criticize quite a bit, but there are people from the left who criticize multiculturalism. When I used to teach sociology, I used to show my students a video where Peter Hatchell, who was an Australian gay rights activist, and Johan Hari, who was an English leftist who's also gay, it was a debate they were having about multiculturalism, where Johan Hari was attacking multiculturalism as being antithetical to left-wing values like women's rights and gay rights and secularism and so forth. So there are a lot of people who disagree with multiculturalism for all sorts of reasons. Political correctness, it's certainly true that that's something that white nationalists criticize. And political correctness does have a very censorious dimension to it in a lot of ways, where the truth or efforts to get at the truth are often obscured in the name of not being offensive or in the name of upholding ideological values and so forth. Also, there's the question of demographic replacement. This is probably one of the main issues that white nationalists will raise. And what I mean by demographic replacement is the fact that, for example, in the United States, it's projected that whites will be just another minority by the mid part of the 21st century. And there's a number of reasons why white nationalists criticize that, but I think the two reasons that I find most compelling, and I think the two arguments that they have that are the most solid, are that one, what will be the fate of whites, future generations of whites, if they become surrounded by ethnic populations with a long-standing history of grievances, deep-seated grudges against whites, perhaps sometimes for valid reasons. But, certainly it's true that one of the basic insights of conflict theory is that former out-groups can often become just as abusive as former in-groups when they become powerful. And, in some other parts of the world, we've seen that. We've seen that groups that were once privileged at some point, perhaps once they lost power, were subject to very extreme forms of repression and persecution. We've seen certain things like that happen to whites in places like Southern Africa, Zimbabwe, and South Africa on some level. And we've saw that happen to some of the ethnic tribes in Africa that had been given privileged positions by the European colonialists. That was something that happened to the Chinese, the ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia following the Vietnam War. The Chinese were a group that had once become prosperous but somewhat unpopular and were subject to ethnic cleansing and so forth. In fact, the phenomena of the boat people that we saw in the United States in the late 70s, where you had a lot of Vietnamese people, a lot of them were actually ethnic Chinese who were essentially kicked out of Vietnam in a process of ethnic cleansing, and of course that happened in Cambodia as well with the Pol Pot regime. There was a lot of racist violence against the ethnic Chinese who, under the older systems, had been a somewhat privileged and prosperous group. So that kind of power relations can certainly shift when it comes to race relations and ethnic relations. And I don't think that white nationalists who raised the question of, what will be the fate of white folks in future generations if they do in fact become a minority group and where they are surrounded or they're in a society where they are dominated by people who have a great deal of hostility towards them. That's something that's worth at least hearing or considering. Also, another question that white nationalists will raise is the question of ethnic preservation and cultural preservation. And there's something to that as well. For instance, if tens of millions of North Americans started to immigrate into Japan, eventually Japan would no longer be Japan. Now, whatever it became, maybe something good or bad, but it wouldn't really be Japan in any recognizable conventional sense. And likewise, many white nationalists will raise the issue of, the indigenous ethnic populations, or at least the white indigenous ethnic populations of Europe, or of North America to become a minority and continue to shrink in size relative to the rest of the population, will they not eventually become, if not extinct, at least something will be lost. Something will be lost in a cultural sense. And I don't know that that argument is much different from some of the arguments that a lot of environmentalists use. I mean, a lot of environmentalists are very zealous about protecting, say, endangered species, not for any particular reason other than aesthetic reasons. We have to keep in mind that about 90% of all species that have ever existed have already gone extinct anyway, and probably we could do without a few more species. But, you know, do we really want to see the spotted owl or the panda bear or any of those kinds of things? Do we really want to see them go the same way as the dodo bird or, you know, animals that from the past that are now extinct? And that's certainly true of population groups as well, and not just white folks. For example, I remember a few years back, Brian Kaplan, who was a libertarian economist, and he's actually Jewish, but he wrote a piece, and he wasn't criticizing this necessarily. He wasn't arguing that this is good or bad, but he was arguing that it just, you know, mathematically speaking, the Jews may eventually disappear as an ethnic group just through out-group marriage, just through out-marriage from their own group. They may eventually breed themselves out. That was something that Brian Kaplan was arguing just from a purely economic and mathematical level. So that kind of thing can certainly happen, and there are certainly ethnic groups from past times that were perhaps once fairly large and identifiable who are to nowadays extinct or nearly extinct, and, you know, sometimes through persecution and repression. You know, for example, the Tasmanian people are a good example, and or sometimes just through other methods, you know, demographic replacement. And these are issues that white nationalists will raise. You know, they'll also raise the issue of the influence of groups like IPAC and foreign lobbies for other countries. Is it really in the interest of, say, the average American that the organized pro-Israel lobby has as much power as it does, as much influence over American foreign policy as it does? And then they'll talk about issues like crime rates among minority groups. I mean, it's certainly true that some of the minority groups have a grossly disproportionately high rate of violent crime compared to their actual numbers, and you know, that has a spillover effect on other communities. It does. I mean, first of all, it's not good for the minority communities themselves that have these high crime rates. It's because they're more likely to be victims of crime or killed by criminals and so forth. But it's not good for other populations either, because it does have a spillover effect. So these are some of the issues that white nationalists will raise in ordinary everyday conversations with them and in their literature. And I don't think any one of these by themselves are bad issues or bad ideas or scandalous in nature. I think all of these points of view are worth hearing and involve issues that are worth discussing. And we also have to consider that there's a lot of variation in white nationalist opinion. It's just like any other kind of political interest group. When it comes to the pro-life people, you have people who advocate promoting their views in a way that's peaceful and not violent, and then you have people that bomb abortion clinics. Among organizations that advocate for all sorts of ethnic and racial groups, you have, on one hand, you have a group like the NAACP, which is a very moderate, middle-of-the-road political organization. I mean, certainly liberal for the most part, but, you know, but still, I mean, within the realm of quote-unquote respectable opinion and certainly nonviolent, and that advocates for the interest of African Americans, or at least as they understand it. You have them, and then you have, say, the Nation of Islam, which is a group that has some beliefs that most people would find a little strange, but they're still peaceful, and they do a lot of good community service work and so forth. Then you have groups like the Yahweh Ben Yahweh sect, which was around some years ago and were basically mass murderers. And you find that kind of variation among white nationalists as well. You know, I've been to gatherings of white nationalists and heard them talk about their ideas and met many of their leading figures and so forth, like the folks from American Renaissance. And while I certainly have my disagreements with them philosophically and about a lot of issues, including race, They don't strike me as inherently rotten people who have completely malevolent intentions. They have, their own issues that they bring to the table and want to have heard. And I might think they have a point on certain things and might disagree with them on other things. But I take their point of view the way I take any other group, whether it's the left or the right or whatever else. And then you have some white nationalist groups that are nonviolent, that are peaceful, that are, conciliatory in their practices, and then you have others that are violent and crazy and psychopathic, and again you find that among all kinds of political factions and ethnic factions, not just among white nationalists. So that's been my own observation of white nationalists and some, the various issues they have and their various factions and manifestations. Now, that said, I mean, there's certainly plenty about white nationalism that I would be critical of. I mean, as I said earlier, I am not a white nationalist, but not by the wildest stretch of the imagination. I am an anarchist, and for me, the issue is the struggle against the state and state-allied institutions. Now, when it comes to cultural values and cultural norms, I'm actually somewhat moderate when it comes to questions like that. I don't really buy into the extremes on the left or the right when it comes to cultural questions, because I think a lot of those extremes miss the boat in a lot of ways. And I was never that into cultural radicalism. And my own cultural tastes are fairly middle of the road. Now, that said, I respect the right of other people to their views, but I don't think that it's necessary to belong to some sort of fringe cultural orientation to be a political radical. I'm interested in politics, not in promoting all sorts of subcultural norms per se. But within the ranks of the white nationalists, I'd see some of the same problems there that I see, ironically, among the left anarchists and among the left in general, in that there does seem to be a great deal of victimology there. For example, if you talk to people from the left, if you listen to the rhetoric of the left, it's all about victimology. It's all about society has done this to us, and our failures are always everyone else's fault. For example, feminists, if you listen to a lot of feminist rhetoric, you'd think that, the world would be heaven on earth if only there were no men on it, or you hear that coming out of the gay rights movement about how we've been so oppressed and abused by society, and any problems we have are somebody else's fault. You hear that among the identity politics interest groups, among a lot of the ethnic minority groups. Every form of social pathology you find in minority communities are dismissed as the fault of racism or whatever. And you find that on the right as well. You find a lot of this kind of victimology on the right, and not just on the racialist right, not just among the white nationalist right. You find it on the religious right. You find people on the religious right who think that because they can't broadcast a prayer over a loudspeaker in public school every day, that they're being oppressed and their religious freedom is being denied. And you find similar thinking among white nationalists. You find people there who really are about out-group hostility towards minorities for its own sake. You do find people who are about blaming everyone else for their problem. It's thinking it's the Jews' fault that they're a loser or whatever, or it's Mexicans' fault or it's black people's fault. You find a lot of that kind of thinking in white nationalist circles. You do find people in white nationalist circles that are psychopaths or at least have serious personality disorders and engage in a lot of antisocial behavior. You do find occasionally violent people that go on shooting sprees. I mean, it's certainly not only white nationalists that do that. I mean, it's people from all kinds of political backgrounds or no political background at all that do that. So some of those stereotypes are true. But in a broader sense, what I'm interested in is the future. And all of the work that I do politically tends to be oriented towards building a future revolutionary struggle with an anarchist orientation. And any approach that I would have to white nationalism or anything else will be rooted in that. I'm interested in examining this question of white nationalism in terms of how it relates to this wider revolutionary anarchist struggle that I'm trying to develop. And in that sense, of course, you know, certainly I would criticize certain strands within white nationalism and certain factions within white nationalism and certain individuals within white nationalism as having beliefs and values that are not compatible with anarchism, just like there are plenty of people on the left who have beliefs and values that are not compatible with anarchism. And there are people that are part of the mainstream conservative-oriented, Republican Party-oriented right who have beliefs and values that are not compatible with anarchism. So I wouldn't hesitate to criticize any of that. At the same time, however, I don't see that there's any need to single white nationalists out for any kind of special criticism. Like one thing that I've always found really rather appalling is whenever, say, a group of white nationalists holds a gathering or rally or meeting, I mean, yeah, irrespective of what kind of white nationalists they are, these radical leftists will come out and engage in these protests against them that are, you know, very militant and provocative in nature, and they're shouting insults, and, you know, they're carrying these tacky hand lettered signs, you know, death to the fascists and things like that. And while I certainly would support their right to protest, I mean, I support anyone's right to protest whatever they want. But at the same time, it seems to me that their protests are really based on a selective indignation. I told one of these Antifa characters once, I told him that I would take his anti-fascist protest seriously, because this was a fellow who claimed to be an anarchist. And I told him I would take his anti-fascist protest seriously when he started protesting against communists as well. It's not uncommon for self-proclaimed anarchists to go to these anti-fascist protests and rallies or whatever and march hand in hand with communists, often very hard-line communists. For instance, I remember reading about a case some years ago, probably about 10 years ago, maybe longer than that, where the NSM group, the National Socialist Movement, which is a very comical, comic book Nazi group, Hogan's Heroes Nazi group that actually puts on the uniforms and that kind of stuff, they were holding some kind of event somewhere, and the left-wing anarchist group NEFEC, the Northeast Federation of Anarchist Communists was what that was an acronym for. But this NEFEC group of left anarchists was out there marching right alongside Trotskyist groups in order to protest the NSM. Apparently they're oblivious to the fact that anarchists were massacred by Trotsky at Kronstadt and elsewhere in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. A lot of these anarchists that go out and march hand in hand with communists around all sorts of leftist causes apparently failed to realize that anarchists and communists fought a civil war in Spain in the 1930s. I really find the hypocrisy of these left-wing anti-fascist groups who, on one hand, they attack us, they attack the system and American Revolutionary Vanguard for having people with, say, you know, less than liberal or less than leftist views about certain things in our own circles. You know, they'll attack us as fascists or whatever, but then they'll go out and march hand in hand with communists and with other left-wing statists. And as I said, you know, I told one of those people once when they start, you know, taking their anti-authoritarianism seriously and applying it consistently, maybe I might listen to them. But that kind of hypocrisy that our critics and our enemies exhibit really is rather remarkable, and I've seen it over and over and over and over again. These left-wing anarchists who have no problem at all collaborating with communists. They have no problem at all collaborating with other left-wing statists, even pro-establishment leftists or liberals. yet at the same time they'll attack us, for having people that don't meet their ideological litmus tests in our own circle. What that says to me is that these people are not serious. Our critics are not serious. Rather, their supposed criticisms of our perspectives and activities are really just a form of special pleading on behalf of their own pet issues and pet causes and so forth. So that's that. Now, as I said, I'm very future-oriented, and I tend to be about what's in the best interest of building an anarchist revolutionary struggle over time, and how white nationalism or any other ism would fit into that. I think that over time, white nationalism will grow as a movement. And I think that what will trigger that is the fact that whites will continue to become a smaller group relative to the wider population, and will eventually be just another minority group like everyone else. And I think that that will ironically raise a certain amount of self-consciousness or ethnic consciousness or whatever you want to call it among white people. And as they start to individually and collectively experience higher levels of things like discrimination or out-group hostility coming from other places. I do think that that will probably happen. As the white population shrinks in size, as the politically correct totalitarian humanist ideology becomes more deeply entrenched, I think we will see a lot more rhetorical hostility towards whites and institutionalized discrimination. So I don't think white nationalists are necessarily wrong in some of their predictions there. I mean, I think they often exaggerate it, but I don't think they're completely wrong either. But as that happens, I do think that white nationalism as a political interest group will start to emerge and become more visible and more prevalent. But I don't necessarily think it will take on the form that it does at present, or certainly won't take on the form that it has in the past. I mentioned earlier in the program that there are a lot of people out there that whenever this question of white nationalism comes up, they just seem to lose their minds. People who are otherwise intelligent, they just seem to have a very reflexive, knee-jerk reaction to any mention of white nationalism. And I think the reasons for that are obvious. I think that that kind of thinking is a reaction against past events. I think really the person who's probably the most responsible for the growth of the PC cult in modern times was probably Adolf Hitler, because I would say that the growth of the PC cult was probably triggered as much by things that he did and things that his regime did as much as anything else. And I think that the PC cult is a backlash. It's a reaction against things like Nazism, the Holocaust, as well as the traditional racial caste systems that we've had in some of the Western societies, and also European colonialism and the legacy of that as well. However, I think that as those things fade into the past to a greater degree and fade from memory to a greater degree, the PC cult and its emotional foundations, its ideological foundations will start to fade as well. And eventually, I think white nationalists will probably emerge as just another kind of political interest group, just like gun owners and gun controllers and pro-life and pro-choice and the ADL and the NAACP and the Sierra Club and all that other stuff like that, any other kind of political interest group. And ironically, I think that white nationalism will probably undergo something of a transformation over time, where a lot of the residual influences that you find in white nationalism even today will probably start to fade as well. I think ironically, as the memory of some of the events of the 20th century starts to fade, some of the residual influences on white nationalism from that time will also start to fade, Still today, within the ranks of white nationalism, you do see at least residual influences, in some instances not even so residual influences of things like old-fashioned American-style white supremacy. For example, the American Renaissance group is a fairly moderate group. They're basically just run-of-the-mill conservatives. But there's also a strand there that I've noticed of old-style 1920s racialism, Madison Grant and Northrop Stoddard and stuff like that. In some white nationalist circles, even today, I see a fascination with things like eugenics, which is a pseudoscience that's widely regarded as having been discredited, and I think rightfully so, at least in my judgment. On the periphery, you still find neo-Nazis and all of that. You still find apologists for old-fashioned racial caste systems. You still find these Holocaust revisionist people that, in my view, are rejecting some basic history. But I respect their right to hold their views and advocate for their views. I'm not saying I would deny that, but I don't agree with their views, is what I'm saying. So I think in the future, though, I think some of that stuff will fade as well, and I think white nationalism will start to take on a much different form, where it's, ironically, I think it'll start to resemble the kinds of identity politics and interest group politics that you find on the left in many ways. Just like on the left, you've got civil rights groups for all of the different traditional minority groups, and you have feminist groups, and you have gay rights and environmental groups and all sorts of other things. And nowadays you have rights groups for transsexuals and animals and all kinds of other people or species. I think you'll find more and more of that kind of thing on the right in the future as well, not only among white nationalists, but also men's rights and religious rights and all sorts of other things. I think that model of identity politics and different groups claiming rights will continue for quite some time. And I think white nationalism will take on that veneer as well. Now, I also see white nationalism in the future moving away from some of its older ways of thinking and becoming more oriented towards a type of cultural nationalism. For example, there's a group called the New Resistance, and some time ago they put out this thing, the New Resistance Manifesto, and they are a group that advocates for working class white people. And they say our people, as we define them, are the white American working classes, in which we include the urban proletariat, the rural poor, those unemployed or underemployed, as well as displaced members of the middle class. And they go on to say that they do not advocate or condone pseudoscientific notions of racial supremacy, biological racism, anti-Semitism, racial purity, or eugenics. And I think something like that, something like New Resistance, is probably the most progressive form of white nationalism and probably will be the future of white nationalism in many ways, or if it even can be called white nationalism. I think New Resistance identify themselves as national revolutionaries rather than as white nationalists per se. But I think a form of white nationalism that tends to have a more populist economic outlook on one hand, and on the other hand, reject some of these older forms of racialism, racial supremacism, biological racialism, crudely reductionist anti-Semitism, eugenics, and things like that, and instead focuses on a form of white nationalism that's more about culture and heritage. I do think something like that will probably emerge in the future and become more influential. And in many ways, it would be very similar to many of the kinds of movements you find on the left or even among indigenous peoples, among native peoples that are somewhat similar. So I've in this program, I've been making an effort to talk a little bit about this, some of these controversies, this label that's always put on Attack the System by leftists as being fascist, racist, Nazi, white nationalist, etc., and explaining a little bit about why we get that label put on us and why it's a false label. And on the other hand, I've also been trying to talk a little bit about the phenomenon of white nationalism and as a philosophy, as an ideology, and you know what I, in my judgment at least, are its strengths and weaknesses, and you know where white nationalists might raise some valid points, and where I might disagree with them, even strongly disagree with them on other things. But my view is that you know, whatever one thinks of white nationalism, I mean whether you are a white nationalist or whether you're stridently anti-white nationalist or casually sympathetic or casually indifferent, we don't need to demonize white nationalists. I know a whole lot of white nationalists, and they're people just like everyone else, and within their ranks you find people that are generally honorable people and have good intentions and try to do the right thing by other people as they understand it. And within their ranks, you also find other people who are rotten people and are, you know, don't have any problem backstabbing other people. And you find that on the left. You know, I've experienced just as much of that on the left as I have on the far right. And you find that within all ethnic groups and within all religious communities and so forth. You know, people are people everywhere. And so there's no need to demonize white nationalists. Rather, like any other political group, the thing to do is to try to understand their points of view and understand their arguments. And it's not necessarily to embrace their views, but it's a good idea to try to at least understand where they're coming from and try to figure out what valid points they might have or what valid grievances they might have against the wider society. And just like we would with any other group, and there's plenty of things that I defend politically or associate with politically even that I don't necessarily agree with personally. I've in recent years, I've spent a lot of time working with the far right and in different forms around different things, even though I'm not a far rightist by any means. And I've, in the past, as I mentioned earlier, I've worked with communists on other issues. I've worked with black nationalists on other issues. And I defend a lot of population groups politically that most other people will not. For instance, I've defended the right of gangs to associate based on freedom of association. I don't necessarily support their right to engage in aggressive violence against other people. But a lot of anti-gang laws I've criticized as a violation of freedom of association. I also think that in the future, as I said, I think that white nationalism in some ways will grow and probably take on a somewhat different form than what people are accustomed to. I think that while that may be a political force that emerges in the future, I also think that there'll be a lot of other types of political forces that emerge in the future that we currently don't see a whole lot of. For instance, it's interesting that some of the critics of things like same-sex marriage will argue that same-sex marriage is just a slippery slope to other things like polygamy and repealing laws against statutory rape or even legitimizing kiddie porn and things like that. And I actually think they're right. I think that in the future, you'll probably see all sorts of movements of people that are considered sexually deviant, even in the current society, coming out, so to speak, and saying we want rights or we want liberation or whatever. I think ironically, from the other end of the cultural spectrum, I think as mass immigration continues to take place, I think there are going to be more and more population groups within the wider society, particularly immigrant subcultures, whose cultural norms are very much at odds with the prevailing liberal paradigm of the wider society. I'm not so sure how well the liberals who champion mass immigration are going to take things like arranged marriages and bride kidnappings and clitoridectomies and things like that, and I think that, or the traditional patriarchal values that you see in some other societies, or the very conservative religious values that you see in some other societies. I don't think the standard middle class liberal establishment is going to take that very very well. And I think that we'll see a lot of political realignments come out of this. In the future, there'll be a lot of immigrant subcultures that are, in fact, at odds with the wider liberal society. There'll be groups like white nationalists and men's rights that rise up in response to the ever-deepening control that political correctness has on institutions. And I think we'll see more traditionally excluded groups. I think there'll be a drug users' rights movement in the future. I think there'll be a prisoners' rights movement in the future. I think there'll be a prostitutes' rights movement in the future. There'll be gangs that become politicized and all sorts of other things. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of political realignments come out of this. And of course, at Attack the System, we're all about the wider anarchist struggle, and we're all about identifying these trends and seeing how we can capitalize on this for the sake of advancing the wider anarchist struggle. And at least in my case, personally, you know, I don't rule out working with anyone. I've always generally looked at it like, you know, the only people that I'm not willing to work with are people who are who have the actual firepower, the actual military power, so to speak, to impose a worse system than we have now. You know, I don't know that, for example, I'd want to work with, say, Islamic fundamentalists who are going around shooting girls in the head for not being properly veiled or something like that. You know, I am, for the most part, willing to work with just about anyone that's against the system and serious about doing something about it. And, of course, in the wider pan-anarchist, pan-secessionist paradigm that we advocate for at attackthesystem.com, you know, we, probably more than any other movement, are capable of including a vast array of population groups and political interest groups, because as enemies of the state and as advocates of radical decentralized societies, it's certainly possible for us to recognize the legitimacy of all kinds of communities for all kinds of people with all kinds of values. So, yes, there could be anarcho-white nationalist, just like there can be an anarcho-black nationalist, and there can be an anarcho-syndicalist and an anarcho-communist and anarcho-capitalist and Muslim anarchist and Christian anarchist and you know, pro-life, pro-choice anarchist, and so forth. That's where I'm coming from, at least. And I've also, in our statement of purpose that's on the homepage at Attack the System, there's a section in there about white nationalism where we talk a little bit about some of these controversies and address some of the questions that are raised. Did want to do a program on this because it is such a controversial issue, such a lightning rod issue, and it's a controversial issue for Attack the System itself. It's a controversial issue in the wider society, so I wanted to try to inject a little bit of nuance and first of all clear up some of the misconceptions about what the relationship between Attack the System and white nationalism actually is, on one hand, and on the other hand, engage in an objective critical analysis of white nationalists in a way that, on one hand, is certainly critical, and as I said, I'm not a white nationalist at all, not by any means, but you know, I don't see the need to demonize white nationalists either. I mean, like I said, they're people like everyone else. I know tons of them, just like I know tons of communists and other people from other kinds of political backgrounds that, you know, people that are more mainstream think are weird or you know, moral lepers in some particular way. So that's not really necessary to do that, to demonize people with these kinds of beliefs. Until then, this is Keith Preston. I'm signing off now. This is Keith Preston for AttackTheSystem.com, and we'll get together again soon. Have a good week.